This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Mark Miller. Hey everyone, it's Josh Flanagan from iFanboy. Yeah, I know it's been a while since I did one of these, but I got this opportunity to speak with comic book superstar Mark Miller. All the way from Scotland. You know Mark from all sorts of things. Tons of them. The Authority, The Ultimates, Kick-Ass, Nemesis, Starlight, Chrononauts. There are so many things. And we're going to talk about a lot of those. We're going to talk about his career. And I don't want to waste any more time doing this, so let's get straight to it. Hey, welcome to iFanboys Talksplode. We have returned, and our special guest today, all the way from Scotland, is Mark Miller.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me. So I was writing questions for this, and I was thinking about what we want to talk about, and you have quite a career. There's a lot of different things that are going on, and interestingly enough, I really saw your name first start to show up when I sort of got back into comics. Everybody has a thing where they get out of comics and they get back in, but around the late 90s, I was in college, and I really started reading comics again, and I saw your name in Flash. And from there, you know, that's sort of around the beginning of you being known. And then a bunch of different waves in your career. Does it feel like you have been at this for a very long time, or that it's gone really fast?
Do you know, it's kind of all I've ever known. You know, like I feel I've no other skills for starters. You know, so like, I couldn't make it in any other career. But like, you know, even the Flash, I think I'd been around for about 7 years by that point. You know, but again, it was all stuff people didn't see. Like I was working in the UK from I was 19 until I was maybe 23, 24. Then I was doing books that nobody was reading in DC. And I was always just kind of keeping my head above the water. I was one of those guys who could have disappeared at any moment and no one would have noticed. You know, so it was like I was so far down the list of favorite writers or guys you would pick up the books or anything. And then the Authority changed everything. I mean, I was getting little bumps on things like Justice League or Justice League minis and things, and people, it was well received, you know. Yeah. But it never led to any ongoing work. So I did find I would be writing scripts for, you know, and getting paid maybe 1 week a month, and the other 3 weeks of the month I was writing proposals, you know, and desperately trying to get work. So I think it all changed. I could put it down to the month and the day, which was March 2000. You know, like the minute Authority issue 13 hit the stands, I suddenly had a career. And it was weird because I'd been around for a decade, but everybody saw that as my first book, essentially. Like, even stuff I really like Superman Adventures, no one has read it.
Yeah, and I knew about that stuff, and I knew that you'd worked for the animated series and things like that, but I think that was when you started to be noticed, and there was that groundswell that got to the Authority. So, like, during that time, which that was pretty normal, about 7-10 years or something like that, kind of toiling. It doesn't really work exactly the same way now.
Yeah.
But what were you thinking during that time? Were you sort of on the edge? I know that like Kirkman tells a story where, for a while, doing The Walking Dead before it blew up, he was in a bad spot. It was really difficult. Did you go through sort of the same thing?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I always made enough money to not need to do another job, mm-hmm. which was, for a writer, that's incredible. You know, I mean, that's kind of what you want, isn't it? You know, like, if you can write stories and somebody is paying you for them, that's like, that's win-win, isn't it? Because you have a good time and you're somehow getting paid. I never made enough that I wasn't always slightly scared or, like, 1 month away from having nothing. You know, so like, I mean, I remember... I mean, some of the companies I worked for, I mean, even DC, I think, when I was starting out, sometimes they would not pay you for like 3 months. And you'd maybe written a story like, you know, 12 weeks before, and you would be phoning on an international call, which was quite expensive then, you know, phoning and saying, look, has someone lost my check? And what used to happen all the time was checks were late coming out, and then they would send them to Scotland with the just amount of postage to get it to Philadelphia. You know, they never thought of it as an international check. So sometimes I'd wait a further 6 weeks for a check to arrive and everything. You know, so my life was quite like that a lot, and like not answering the door just in case someone was kind of like looking for cash or something, you know. So that's why it's really weird. I do think now in hindsight, it does make me appreciate that my life's been pretty good since March 2000, you know. Because if you've been through that, then you just think this is awesome. You know, I mean, if people are buying your books and you're getting royalties or they're making films or whatever, any of these things, you can't believe your luck that you're even able to answer your front door again. Yeah.
Do you consider it luck? Or oh, I mean, you obviously put a lot into it.
Yeah, I mean, but it's funny. I think what the luck is that the kind of things I'm interested in writing, fortunately, are the kind of things other people are interested in. Because you can be brilliant but niche, you know. And there's some guys I really love who've never really found the mass market. And whenever they do something, you know, like a big superhero project or whatever, they're not enjoying themselves because it's not what they really want to be writing. But I think my luck is that what I'm into is what kind of everyone else is into too. Like, I mean, I remember years ago somebody asked me my 5 favorite films, and I was like Star Wars, Jaws, Superman, The Godfather. And the guy stopped me halfway through it and said, don't say that. Everybody will think you're an idiot. And I was like, but it genuinely is my favorite stuff, you know. So I think I'm very lucky that my tastes are mainstream, because if you're going to work in the media, I guess it's a plus.
But those are all very good quality mainstream films. I'd say at least 3 of those are with my favorite films too. So that's easy to go with. But
you know,
there's this idea that mainstream means bad, and that's not true. I mean, The Godfather is a great example of a movie that was incredibly mainstream, but also incredibly high quality. It's rare.
It's funny. I think if you adjust The Godfather for inflation, it made as much money as Transformers, which is nuts, isn't it? You know, but I do love that, you know, because I think people are smart. I think generally people are smart, you know. So the reason Star Wars sold a lot of tickets is because it was really good, you know. And I watched Jaws once a year. It's a perfect movie, and
it is.
And it made a lot of money because it was really good, you know. So that, as a writer, that always gives me hope that sometimes things that are really good break out and everybody's happy, you know.
Well, you're in the Jaws team, so we're on the same side here. So that's just gonna be easy from here. Take it back, I guess, a little bit further. Actually, you know what? I just want to continue on a thing. So during that time, that sort of long paying dues period, you know, was there ever a point where you thought, I don't know if I can keep doing this? Did you ever have a plan B?
Only once, actually. And it was just before things took off, thank God. It was really weird because, like I say, my whole life, I'd only wanted to do comics. So any other career, a plan B would have been devastating to me. You know, it'd be like wanting to play football or something and ending up as a lawyer or whatever. You know, it had just been so different from what I'd envisioned as a kid for my adult life. Like my plan when I was 5 was to be doing what I'm doing now. I used to make my own comics when I was 5 and sell them to neighbors. I used to, and it was kind of like the way monks used to write the Bible before printing presses were invented. I would hand draw each one individually and sell the copies around the neighbors, like, and do a new version of it and spend a week drawing it up again, you know, that kind of thing, you know. So it was mental. And my dad eventually started photocopying them for me, and that was revolutionary for me, you know. But like, you know, so it had been a passion my entire life, and the idea that it just wasn't happening for me, you know, maybe around about 1999, things still hadn't quite taken off. And I just had my first kid then as well, my oldest daughter. Yeah. And I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, I really need to kind of make this work now. You know, it's not just me. You know, it's I have a little person that I have to feed and clothe, you know. And You know, I don't want her looking like the smelly kid at school, you know, like she's, I need to do something here. So as a little plan B, what I did was I wrote a proposal for a television series, and I had no contacts in that world at all. I didn't even know the name of who I was supposed to send it to. I literally wrote commissioning editor at the top, you know, of an envelope. And what I did was I posted it off, and then about a week later, I got a phone call and they bought it. It was really weird, you know, and like, I thought, oh my God, this is really easy, you know, like...
It may well have been good, but there was definitely a component of luck there, I think.
Yeah. Or it was a prank. It was a prank someone was playing, you know.
Yeah.
But they called up and they bought a series from me, and I was like, oh my God, you know, this is fantastic. You know, this you know, like I say, I'd spent most of the previous 2 years writing proposals for DC Comics, mm-hmm. and there was this dreadful editor there, you know, who used to just toy with freelancers, you know, just out of boredom, you know. And I remember I rewrote a Phantom Stranger proposal 30 times. And people were saying to me, are you mad? And I was like, I need to get this gig. You know, I really need it. I need to get this perfect. Not realizing the guy was just sitting back stroking his like white cat, you know, just getting paid on DC's dime just to have a little fun. And he actually said, oh, it was terrible. And he actually said to a friend of mine, he says, oh, I'm just messing with Miller. I've no intention of commissioning this thing, you know. And I was like, I heard this after like 18 months, you know. And like... I remember selling the thing to Channel 4 in the UK and just getting a check, and I thought, this is amazing. This is really great. And this was maybe about 2 months before Authority launched in March 2000. And then luckily Authority happened and I was able to not do the television thing, which sounds weird. Like mm-hmm. most people, I think, would assume that you would want to get into television. But for me, it's always been about comics. So I literally... just sidestepped the whole TV thing, and that department actually imploded in the television company that I'd been dealing with. But like, but I'd already made my decision. I was actually off doing comics, what I'd always wanted.
Mm-hmm. So after that sort of crisis of faith, did you do anything differently in terms of how you approached the work? Like, did you buckle down? It sounded like you were working pretty hard ahead of that, or you know, your daughter's there. You've got to definitely deal with it. Did sort of your approach to the work change?
Totally. And it's so funny. I mean, for anybody who's listening and thinking about being a writer, this is the best piece of advice I can give, because I discovered this kind of accidentally. Like, I wrote the first issue of The Authority when I thought I was leaving comics, because you have to remember this was a book that was being published by, you know, a sort of a company within DC at Wildstorm. You know, it was no guarantee of future income for me, you know. I was an untried writer, and believe it or not, at that time, Frank Quitely was a very new artist, you know, so... Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch leaving that book was almost like, cancel me, you know, like the minute they left, it was like, okay, here's two guys, you know, you don't care about coming onto this book. So there was absolutely no guaranteed income, you know, so I still was thinking, okay, this may not work, but what I'm going to do is, if this is the last superhero comic I write, I'm going to do the comic I want to read. And it sounds so incredibly obvious, but I'd never done that until that point. When I was writing... you know, the Phantom Stranger proposals or Secret Society of Supervillain proposals, all these things, I was thinking, okay, what would the DC editors want? What might DC readers want, you know? And I was trying to tailor it towards a specific trend, which in the late 1990s was very retro 60s, you know, just the way these things tend to move in cycles. And I was trying to anticipate as opposed to actually thinking, what do I want to read? Mm-hmm. And luckily, like I said, what I wanted to read is what other people did too, and the sales on the book went up. And it just seemed to catch fire, and that led to gigs at Marvel and everything. So, but that was a life-changing moment. The minute I produced a book for me, then by osmosis, that excitement, you know, it's contagious. Other people went into it.
That's literally the same story of sort of the legend of like Stan Lee's Fantastic Four. I mean, that was the idea. He'd been doing all these things, and his wife was like, before you quit, just do the one book you want to do.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's the sort of, I mean, just a legend.
That's a good legend, you know, because it's true. But a man without hope is a man without fear, as they say. Mm-hmm. You know? So, and I think that does make you do the kind of stuff that you just think, you know, what the hell, this may work or it may not, who cares, you know, I'll enjoy it, you know.
There's a certain bit of recklessness that I think can get rewarded with that if you're worried, then you're not going to, but if you just want to jump, then you can get a lot done.
Well, I think sometimes the best creativity comes in those moments when there's nothing to lose. Like if you look at Marvel, for example, I think Marvel's most fertile period over the last 15 years was the 5 years following near bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, that period Marvel was absolutely on fire, and it was because they had nothing to lose. You know, I forget what the share price was, but it was down to something like a dollar a share or something.
It was in the pennies, and I remember looking at that going, I should buy some of that. It'd be funny. That was stupid.
And then, you know, whenever a company's $50 a share, then they're not going to take risks. Mm-hmm. You know, whenever. So the risk-taking time was really amazing. You know, you had books like Ecstatics, you had Kevin Smith on Daredevil, Grant Morrison on X-Men, you know, Brian Bendis coming in and revolutionizing and Spider-Man and everything, and it was such an incredible Wild West environment to be in, and I, you know, there was some rubbish in there as well, but I would say the hit rate was generally very high, probably very similar to the early 1980s Marvel as well, that was just coming out of that 70s recession. Mm-hmm. And just thinking, let's take a risk on these guys like Frank Miller and so on doing comics that you've never seen before. It's always a good time.
No, absolutely. I think we could use another one of those.
A recession. Yeah.
So I want to take it back a little bit. And when you first, I mean, you said you've wanted to do comics since you were a little kid. What was it that you loved about comics at first? What was the thing that made you fall in love with them?
Do you know the funny thing is it goes so far back for me that I can't remember not loving them. So weirdly, I can't answer that because, like, I've been in love with the characters as long as I can remember existing. You know, like I can't remember not knowing who Superman is or Batman or Spider-Man or whatever. I remember very early comics of mine just because the covers are so poignant for me, you know. So I can remember the first ones that I had, but I can't remember what drew me in. I just thought, I have my dinner around 5 o'clock, you know, I go to school around 9 a.m. I read comics, you know, it's just part of my day.
Okay, well, let me take it forward then. As you got older and you approached and you started making comics, professional comics, very young.
Yeah,
I guess when was it then you started to appreciate the form of comics, the way that they actually work, the craft of them?
Do you know what? That's probably down to Alan Moore. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was 13, just about the age that you're getting out of comics, and I think I didn't quite get out of them. I remember feeling I should, you know, when I went to high school. Like over here, we go to high school when we're 11 or 12. And I remember giving all my comics to charity when I was 11 or 12. I had like a yard sale kind of thing, and I got rid of everything. I kept one or two very special ones, you know, ones I really loved. And I thought, now I'm a man, I'm 11 or 12, you know, I'm getting rid of my comics, I'm probably going to get married now. You know, so I had this whole sort of ritual. It was like a rite of passage. I was like, goodbye, Superman, you know, you served me well, you know. And then about a month later, I was like, I need to get all of those comics back, you know. And it became an obsession. Like the next couple of years, I was just tracking down everything I'd sold for this charity yard sale thing, you know. And it was weird. Like, I think probably at an age where most people would give up, then I discovered Alan Moore. I was 13, and Alan Moore wasn't quite famous at this point. He was just starting on Swamp Thing. Issue 26 of Swamp Thing had just come out. So Alan's first one was issue 20, I think. So he'd been doing that a few months. And he wasn't quite a superstar yet. He was just kind of very respected in the British scene. People loved him on Warrior and Miracle Man and everything. And I got talking to him at this convention where I didn't know anyone. I was a kid from a small town, and I was at this convention that only maybe had 200 guests, you know, 200 attendees and a hotel. And I just started speaking to him, and it was back in the days where he was so new that I could talk to him for an hour and nobody interrupted. It was really weird. And I just asked him, you know, what have you got coming up and blah, blah, blah. And I was just excited because a British guy was working in DC, and he told me about Swamp Thing, and I was like, all right, you know. And like he told me he and Dave Gibbons were planning a Superman annual, which would come out a couple of years later. And he told me the plot of it, and he had a map of the Fortress of Solitude, which he was using to plot out the story and everything. And I was like, this is amazing, you know. And I was just so inspired by the idea of a British guy being into it. And it was kind of the realization that I could maybe do this as a job, like a guy from this rock that we live on over here, you know, mm-hmm. could work in the States, which seemed incredibly glamorous. And what he did was so nice. I remember, I think it was about 35p, which is about 60 cents. And I didn't have any money left. I'd only come along with the equivalent of $1 or $2 or something. And he said to me, why don't you check out my Swamp Thing? And I was like, well, I've no cash left at all. And he bought it for me, and he signed it, and I still have it, you know. And I always took that as kind of like Willy Wonka handing you the golden ticket kind of
thing. Really is. When you said it was Alan Moore, I thought you meant you read a book, but no, it was actually Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, yeah, and he gave me the book, and I went home, and I was like, one day, you know, I'll see this man again, you know, and I'll be a comic writer too. And I sent my first proposal into DC then, you know, about 2 weeks later, mm-hmm. When I was 13, and I got a really lovely 15-page rejection letter, but it was actually... And because I said to them, I'm very interested in becoming a writer, an artist, an inker, a letterer, a colorist, or possibly an editor, you know, and could you give me information on you know, all of these things? And they were so nice. It was Dick Giordano's brother-in-law, who was the talent coordinator at the time, a guy called Sal Amendola. And he wrote, I still have that letter as well, because it was on DC-headed paper. I remember just being so excited when it landed through my letterbox. I was like, this is amazing. You know? And again, I took that as, you know, this is my destiny. One day I'll work here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if we skip forward then, I mean, you've been in comics a long time. You understand how they work better than most humans who are walking the earth. What is it that comics do for you now? Because you could have stopped doing them. You could make a living doing other things, but you're still making these comics. So what is it about them?
I just love them. You know, I mean, I'll tell you, there's two massive things. One is I love the complete creative freedom that comics have, because having worked in movies and everything, I see the restrictions, you know. I mean, the number of people involved in a movie is incredible. There's 300 people or something involved in a movie. And then there's guys who come in and say, look, we cannot afford to shoot that scene. Is there any way we can clip that down, you know? And compromise is inevitable. And I've been very lucky at my four films. I'm really, really happy with them, the four that have been done so far. But I can see how it can go wrong as well. And I've seen it happen to friends, where just somebody on a whim who you don't know can say, oh, I don't really like the way this is going, and change everything, you know? And you can end up with something you're not happy with, because once you've signed the movie rights away, you have to give up a certain amount of control. What's amazing about comics is that what is in your head is on the page just a few months later, which in itself is exciting. And it's very autonomous. Outside of a novel, it's the most autonomous art form, you know? So there's the writer, the artist, and a piece of paper. And I love that. And budget is never a consideration. So that's cool. The other thing is, this is going to sound mad, but I just like having it. You know, like I'm sitting in my office just now. I've got an old 1950s spinner rack that's filled with 900 of my favorite comics, which I spent 2 days thinking about what I was going to put in there, you know. And like, you know, and I like it. This is the one thing that nobody ever says anymore, but there kind of is a nice sense of like looking at a run of your comics and thinking, yeah, that feels pretty good. I've got the complete set of them. You know, my inner 10-year-old, you know, still feels very satisfied by that. And it's just, you're either into this or you're not, and I've been into it my whole life. Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose that you made some comments about digital comics once that made everybody freak out. It's not hard to make people freak out on the internet, obviously. Yeah. But I assume that the physical object really, really does it for you.
It does. I mean, I've become a digital convert. I was very suspicious, just from an economic point of view, that what I was worried about was, if you look at the comic stores in the West in particular, you know, a very sizable chunk of them are hanging by their fingernails. You know, like there's so many friends of mine who say, if I drop 10%, I'm get out of business. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and it's always a concern. I mean, the industry goes through ups and downs, it always has, always will. But I remember just when people were saying, you know, I'm not sure if I'll be here next year. Suddenly there was the advent of digital. And I think this was maybe around about 2011, 2012, that I questioned the model. The thing that freaked me out was I didn't think they were going to stay at the same price as print. I thought that $2.99 thing just wouldn't work as a digital thing, and they were maybe going to try and do them for $1.99, $1.50, 99 cents even, you know, and do a day and date release with comic stores. So I thought the last thing comic stores need right now is competition. I think this was 2011, and I was just nervous about it, and I held my books back, and I purposely did it, I think, for two to three years, and I held them back, and I just wanted to see what happened first. Like, I've always hung around comic stores. A lot of my friends are retailers. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't feel very gung-ho about saying, okay, here's an alternative place to buy your comics, you know. And I was watching friends who are fans stop buying print and start buying digital. And that freaked me out, because I thought, if we lose 10% and if they drop the price point and we lose 20 or 30% or something, that's a lot of comic stores going out of business. And the comic stores have been our lifeblood for two generations, sure. You know. So I just thought, I mean, I'm just relatively cautious on the fiscal side of things. And I just wanted to have a look at it. So I looked at it over, I think, about, you know, 10 financial quarters. And I think it was 2012 to about 2014. And I looked at it, and it grew incrementally. I think in one of those quarters, I think it shrunk, and I think the rest actually grew. So digital actually wasn't going to be competing. If anything, it was bringing people in, because when I spoke to retailers, what they said was their worst fears weren't realized, and what was happening was people were maybe picking something up on digital and then coming in and buying the trades, you know, or coming in and buying the set because they wanted the paper. And people generally were buying digital because they didn't live near a comic store. And I thought, who am I to deprive someone of their comics because they live 200 miles from a comic store, you know? Yeah. So I thought, you know what, let's have a go. And it's great, you know, but I don't know, I feel, I'm always going to say I was right, you know, but like, I do feel I was right to be a little cautious because, you know, we live in an ecosystem, you know, and you don't want to mess with it sometimes.
A fragile one. And that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, I feel like they're two different businesses. And I think that's what people didn't realize at first.
Different
kind of customers. They had, you know, one customer wanted the thing they could hold and one person wanted the thing they, you know, was convenient. And those weren't the same people.
Exactly. What I was very nervous about was that it was the same person. Mm-hmm. And the only thing to do then is shave sales off print. And I'm so pleased I was wrong.
Yeah. I think it's been good for everyone. Shifting gears, I guess, a little bit. Now, one of the things I notice as I look over your oeuvre, especially your creator-owned stuff, I think that there are a handful of guys who are very good at picking collaborators. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one thing that when a lot of people are breaking in, they're going to get any artist they can to work on their thing.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't quite at that point, but I feel like you've been very conscientious about the people you're working with. Obviously, you know, you've worked with really big names over and over, but it's like it's consistent. Is that... I have to assume it's more than just a vanity thing, but it's conscientious. Like you know that in order to sell things, that you know the art has to be at the top of the game over and over. I mean, how important is that to you?
To me, it's actually not so much from a sales point of view because sometimes I'll pick people who have a pretty small track record in sales. I just pick people who are really good,
Not so much sales. Even it's you know there's guys just Duncan Fegredo or something like that. Where he's you know he's not a huge seller, but he's if you talk to artists, like, oh, that guy's he's a master. You know that kind of thing. And I think I see that across all of the people that you're working with in one form or another, which is pretty impressive.
It's amazing. I mean, when I look at the back page of the Mellow World books and I see all the front covers of all the books that I've worked on, even I'm constantly impressed by the level of artists that I'm working with. Like, these guys are good, you know. I mean, if you compare the Mellow World books, you know, sort of pound for pound with a Marvel or a DC lineup of books, you know, like every guy I'm working with would be their best guy, you know, pretty much, you know, whether it's Frank Quitely or, you know, any of these guys are amazing. And like I say, I don't look at their sales. What I do is I just think, who would be the best possible guy to draw this? Like, for example, Starlight. I wanted to do a book that was, that had a slightly retro Alex Toth vibe, but at the same time had a European sensibility. Like, sci-fi is a funny one to do in comics. It doesn't always quite work, you know? So the vision that I had in my head was something that didn't look very American. And Toth had a very 60s European vibe to his stuff. And I had a lot of Mobius in my head because that's generally, as a European, what I think of when I think of science fiction. So I wanted something that blended both of them. So I was never going to go to like one of the Image Founders or something like that. You know, like, it just wouldn't work for what I had in my head. And Goran Parlov's books, by Marvel standards, sell generally quite modestly. You know, it tends to, although I think they're actually Marvel's best books, you know, they tend to sell a little less than, you know, what you would get on Spider-Man or whatever. So I just thought he was the perfect guy for it. Like, I couldn't see it as anyone other than him drawing the books. And the same thing with Kick-Ass. I mean, I said to John Romita back in 2006, I've got an idea for this thing. It was going to be based around Hit-Girl at the time. And I said, I'd love you to draw this book. And if you don't draw it, I'm not going to do it. And he said, well, I'm under contract for 2 more years. I've got to do this stuff. And I was like, I'll wait. And Kick-Ass sat in my drawer for 2 years until Johnny was ready to start drawing it in 2008, you know? I think he started late 2007. So... I don't know, it's kind of like casting an actor, I find this as well. I mean, I'm involved quite deeply in casting as well. And for Starlight at the moment, we're talking about people, and Kronos, we're talking about people. And once you have someone in your head, it's very hard to think of someone else. You know, sometimes things don't go to plan and you don't get the actor you wanted. And it's the same with artists too. So anybody else would feel like a compromise. So I pick the guys I love and feel right for the project.
Was there a point? And I ask this because there's a point where I had been talking about and writing about comics for so long that it really clicked for me what made a great artist.
Yeah.
Again, it's difficult to say what that is objectively. There's that person has it. Goran Parlov is an excellent example, not a household name, but as soon, you know, when I was reading Fury Max, I thought, oh my God, he's an amazing cartoonist.
I love that book.
Was there a point for you, and you started working really young, was there a point for you where you really felt you understood the mechanics of comic book art and sort of what works and what doesn't, that you can make those kind of decisions?
Kind of. I guess it's like any trade. I mean, mm-hmm. comics, movies, carpentry, you know, plumbing, all these things are just trades, you know, and as you do them more, you tend to get better, you know, and you tend to kind of see what's wrong with things. You can look at something and analyze it and see very quickly what's wrong with it. And it's a skill you pick up. And I find when I'm in story meetings, in Hollywood, even though I'm relatively new to Hollywood, I've had such kind of training in what makes a story work and what doesn't make it work that I find I can be quite incisive and just sort of look at something and say what feels good about it, what doesn't, whether it's in the edits after a movie's been made or at script stage. You know, so I think just over the years you pick up these skills. I think I always knew good art, but I think the type of artist who works well with you specifically is a very different thing too.
Sure.
Like for example, a guy like Jim Lee is fantastic. You know, you put him with a Jeff Loeb or a Geoff Johns or something, and it looks amazing. But that type of art wouldn't work with my type of story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I need guys who do the beat-by-beat thing, and it's quite hard to describe, but I need somebody who will do roughly 4 panels a page, and it flows in a certain way, you know? And Jim is more of a kind of splashy, you know, a big image kind of guy. And Mark Silvestri is like that too, you know? And they're fantastic draftsmen and really great. And with certain writers, they'd be amazing. But for me, the couple of occasions I've worked with artists in that style, it tends not to work out very well. You know, whereas you take somebody who's very good at writing for those kind of artists and give them a Steve Dillon or a Frank Quitely or something, and it doesn't quite gel, you know? So I don't know. I think you just have to find who works for you. It's like dating someone, or it's like a friendship or something. You know, there's a chemistry when you put two creative people together that either works or it doesn't. I mean, a perfect example, you know, would be something like that movie The Mexican. You know, like everybody's like, oh, it's going to be amazing. It's, you know, Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt. How couldn't this be amazing? And it's terrible, you know, and it's chemistry is just really important. And if you get on with them personally, I find it helps too. I mean, most of these guys are my friends that I work with, so the collaboration's fun.
I remember the first time that kind of clicked for me, I think Bendis was talking one time about working with different artists, and he goes, you know, I just couldn't work with Tony Harris. There's nothing wrong with his art. And I clicked. I was like, oh, I totally understand that.
Do you know, it's funny because again, I find the opposite, that I love Tony.
Yeah.
Like Tony's amazing. Like, I'll tell you a funny thing. Like, he and I had been doing that comic War Heroes. It started back in 2008. And the first time we met, we hadn't even spoken on the phone. The first time we met was in New York at the beginning, I think it was August or something, the beginning of the War Heroes tour. And Image had booked us into doing this signing that ran from New York all the way through all these southern states up into LA and then finally up in San Francisco. And I think it was about 9 days or something we were going to be together. And we had never met until we sat down at the Midtown Comics table, shook hands, and then started signing copies of the book, you know. And we got on like a house on fire. Like, we just got on so well. And I remember by the 9th day or whatever, I remember Tony and I were standing.
It's okay,
in the
I have kids. It's fine.
Oh yeah, that's. I think that's kid 3.0. That's the latest one. You know, she's squealing outside. We were in the airport together, and like we were saying goodbye to each other, and it was like Mowgli saying goodbye to Baloo at the end of Jungle Book. You know, we were so sad because we actually had really got on great over the course of that week and a bit. You know, so I don't know. Sometimes the most surprising friendships emerge in comics. You know?
Yeah, I've heard that story from other creators who, you know, they didn't. I think I was around when Jason Aaron first met Gera, his Scalp collaborator, or
yeah.
I've heard other stories like that where people just get along. You know, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo are fast friends now. They weren't at first, but they were open about that. But anyway, it's really neat how that collaboration somehow is organic. And like, if you can work together that way, I mean, people I've done comics with that nobody has had a chance to read, like, we get along really well. I've made really good friends doing that. So I like that part about the process a lot. Let's talk a little bit about process, about scripting, about how you approach a comic and make a book. You know, you said, you know, the Jim Lee kind of style isn't necessarily working for you. How do you start? Like, you've got an idea for a book. Where do you begin?
always with a drawing. Like when I was starting out, I would sort of doodle as well, you know, and sort of try and sell stuff as an artist. Like I would do when I was a teenager, I tried to sell strips to newspapers and things, you know, so I would draw that stuff as well. And for me, I'll sit and draw the characters and then maybe draw a scene that the characters are in and then organically grow the story out of that. So for example, Wolverine, Old Man Logan, I was just drawing a picture of Wolverine, you know, as you do, you know, sitting in your chair drawing Wolverine. And I drew this picture, but he had grey cropped hair. He didn't have, you know, that kind of weird hairstyle Wolverine's got.
That we have no word for except for Wolverine
yes.
hair.
Nobody in real life has that hair.
Nope.
It's like a hat. So like I was drawing this picture of this cropped haired, sort of Will Money kind of looking Wolverine, and he looked kind of old, and I was drawing lines around his face. And then I just wrote beside it, hasn't popped his claws in 50 years. And then I was, you know, it was the whole Unforgiven thing was coming through. And then I was like, oh, why hasn't he popped his claws? And then I thought, well, what would be the one reason Wolverine wouldn't pop his claws? It would be because he killed someone he loved, you know? And then I thought, well, maybe he killed everyone he loved. And why would that have happened, you know? And the story worked its way backwards. I tend to reverse engineer stories from a drawing, you know? So that then I thought, well, he would have to, you know, have his senses completely annulled by someone like Mysterio or whatever, or Mastermind or something like this, you know? So the whole story then came from that drawing, and I worked my way backwards. Kick-Ass was the same. I drew a picture of a kid in a wetsuit confronting bank robbers kind of thing, and they shoot him and he ends up in hospital on his first night. And like, you know, that tells you everything you need to know about Kick-Ass, and you work your story backwards from there. So that's my process every time. I don't know if anyone else does that, but you know, my office is filled with little post-it notes of violent scenes like that, you know, so and stuck all over the walls. You know, it looks like a place the police would break into.
So you have things pretty well thought out before you approach scripting.
Oh my God, especially now, I've completely changed the way I work. I think around about 2012, right about the time I was starting Jupiter's Legacy, I spent 8 weeks working out the backstory. Never mind the plot. I spent 8 weeks working out the backstory. And I must have looked like a mental patient. You know, I was standing with post-it notes all over my office and then into my dining room. And I'd post-it notes for 8 weeks. And I was like, okay, so his mum didn't get on with his aunt, things like that. And I really had this gigantic backstory, which my agent said to me when we were waiting on Frank Quitely to draw book two. He said, like, tell that story. And that's what Jupiter's Circle became, you know, the story about the previous generation of the people who ran Jupiter's Legacy. So I work it out in the most intense detail. And I would say my books since 2012 have been my best ones, you know, they're the ones I feel are stronger. And I think it's because the plot is so tight. You know?
Well, I actually have a question about that specifically, because for me, there is a shift in your work. Mm-hmm. There's the last sort of handful of books that you did, Jupiter's Legacy Circle, Starlight. I try really hard not to call it Stardust because my mouth wants to. So make sure I get it right. I'm just apologizing ahead of time. You know, they had a different feel. If you told me previously how I could pick out a Mark Miller book, I could have, and I wouldn't have written these as, you know, I wouldn't have thought of these as Mark Miller books. They seem like a different thing. So what happened with you in there? I mean, do you see them that way?
Kind of, you know, but you know, the funny thing is the stuff that is darkest or most violent or whatever, or most shocking, that's the stuff that people tend to buy more of, you know, and it's the ones that they talk about. So even though something like Nemesis, for example, is only 4 issues and maybe 10 weeks work or something, people will be talking about it 2 or 3 years later, or they'll be making a film of it or something. And when the movie comes out in 2017 or whatever, they'll be talking about it all over again. But it's maybe just been 10 weeks work for me back in 2009 or something, you know. So it is quite interesting that I can work on something like The Ultimates, which is 26 issues long, I think.
And I was 26 years old and I got really scared. And I was like, it's not that bad, is it?
It took 26 years to do it. Yeah. But like, but 26 issues long, and, you know, there isn't even the word damn, I think, that you couldn't say God damn. Sure. In it, you know, it was, and you weren't allowed to show blood or anything. You know, we made it have a realistic vibe without actually doing anything mature in it. The book was aimed at a PG audience the whole time, and so was X-Men, and 90% of my Marvel stuff was like that. But weirdly, people don't remember that. What people remember is maybe the slightly more violent thing. So it's interesting, but I've always done romantic or sort of nostalgic stuff or whatever. Like Marvel 1985 is probably the most
sort
of nostalgic thing I've ever done, you know. But because it didn't have a huge audience compared to something like Wanted or whatever, you know, then people just don't, they probably don't even realize I've done it, you know. know. So it's interesting. But what's happening now, what's pretty cool, is I think the trend since about 2010, 2011, has been to go more upbeat and light. So I think the market tends to kind of go for stuff now that's a bit more like what I'm wanting to do at the moment. So, for example, I think a book like Kick-Ass, as it was written in 2008, wouldn't work. And at the moment, you know, like there was a shift around 2010 where I found as a reader, I was more interested in stuff that was less badass and more funny and exciting, you know? So Guardians of the Galaxy epitomizes what I'm into at the moment, whereas The Dark Knight epitomized what I was into back in the noughties.
I definitely have that same kind of feeling. I think I would be reductive to say, does it have anything to do with having kids? But for me, there's definitely there's a line. There's where I'm like, oh, I don't, that stuff makes me uncomfortable now.
But it really does. And it's weird. Like, if I was writing something now, I don't think I'd be very interested in writing something violent. Like, violence doesn't especially interest me. But I know I will again at some point. You know, I might think in 5 years' time, wouldn't it be cool to do a really violent, badass book, you know? But just at the moment, what I'm interested in is something that's kind of fun, kind of jokey, adventurous, you know? But in the same way that I love Robert Zemeckis and I love Steven Spielberg, but equally I love Quentin Tarantino and Sam Peckinpah, you know? But there are moments where somebody captures the zeitgeist, you know? And I think right now the zeitgeist is... we're in a post-Guardians world now, which I love.
Yeah. It's very fun. Speaking, I guess, of the sort of different kind of comics, you know, I'm sure you've heard this, and I'm not saying it, but I know that I've heard it said about you that a lot of books were just made for as adaptation vehicles and things like that.
Yeah.
Now, I know from being a comic book reader and looking at, say, the stuff you've done for the last, you know, these are comics. You know, they're made as comics. They've got A-plus artists on them. They're not, you know, how do you feel about that? How do you think about it? How do you react to it?
It honestly drives me nuts. I mean, the thing that I always say to people, I mean, for starters, number one is, what is a movie? You know, it's like, you know, like a movie is a story, you know, told with words and pictures and music or whatever. A comic is a story, you know. So a comic can be anything and a movie can be anything. And, you know, like Grand Budapest Hotel and Transformers and, you know, G.I. Joe are all movies. They're all quite different. You know, they've all got a different vibe. So you can't do something that somebody says, that looks very like a movie to me. You know, I think I'll make that one into a film. You just tell a good story. And what's interesting, actually, is I would say the opposite. I think when people do a book that you cannot imagine in a million years would be a movie, that's when they pick it up as a movie. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at stuff like Ghost World or Scott Pilgrim or Kick-Ass, I mean, Kick-Ass is a weird comic. You know, it's a really weird comic. It seems incredibly niche, although it sold well. You know, the actual idea of it is it's not a winner. You know, like, I mean, think about it. I mean, it's the complete opposite of what makes a superhero book generally sell. You know, it's a guy with no powers, a crap costume, and he always gets beaten up and everything. You know, so I mean, and you know, he's jerking off in like the first issue and everything. You know, and you've got a foul mouth 10-year-old. You know, and I think every single studio in town turned it down when we took it out. You know, like nobody wanted to make that movie, which is why Matthew went off and made it independently with his own private financing and then sold it to a studio once people kind of got what the idea was. You know, so if anything, I've kind of done the opposite. And I would say all of these things you wouldn't imagine ever as a movie. And when you see guys coming up with a plot where they say, oh, this is kind of Jurassic World meets Avatar, you know, like those are bad, as bad comics that then become bad movies. And so they would never become a movie, you know. Like I see people doing that stuff all the time, but you know, again, even Starlight. I mean, I sold Starlight before the first issue came out. I sold it to Fox, and again on paper, you know, who would care? Generally, you would imagine like only I would care about this kind of thing. You know, like an old Buck Rogers kind of type space hero, you know, in his 60s, you know, coming out of retirement to have one last hurrah, you know, like good luck selling that to a studio, you know, but you know, like, so I think what I do is I just write what I want to write. And the other reason it's crazy, you know, to suggest that I would do it to sell movies is I give half the money away. Like my deal is crazy. Like I've been a producer now for 11 years. So my deal with the studios has obviously subsequently gone up every year. Like if I'm selling something, I get executive producer money and I get points on the back end of what the movie does. But now the last kind of maybe four deals that I've done, I also get a percentage of first dollar gross, which is great. You know, I mean, that can be much more money than the rights, the movie rights money. And I, as far as I know, I'm the only creator who halves that with the artist. I half everything with the artist because I've just got this philosophy that, you know, it's like being a mum and a dad. You know, it's like, you know, it's the two of you it took to make this thing, you know. So I don't want to be shown up in a helicopter, you know, to a premiere and the artist is, you know, sort of crawling along the ground starving and all that. You know, I think
you don't want to make Sean Murphy mad.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, so I just think it's only fair. Everybody loves 50-50. You know, my agent said to me, are you crazy? He said, why don't you at least make it 51-49? And I was like, what's the point of that? You know, I said, like, I want it to be 50-50, then everybody's happy. And like, and you know, if I just sold them directly as movies, I would have all the money instead of half the money, you know? And Chrononauts is a perfect example. I mean, I'd sold that as a film before I even started writing it as a comic. Because 3 years previous, I was going to direct it as a short movie for Ridley Scott. And, like, yeah, it was going to be a 10-minute movie, believe it or not. And, you know, but then that fell through and I ended up telling the head of Universal about it over lunch. And he said to me, I'll buy it as a movie. And I said, well, let me do it as a comic. I don't see it as a film. I see it as a comic. And then he subsequently, you know, sort of bought it by the end of lunch, you know.
Now, this might be me coming from comics, but as a person who comes from comics, how long is it till you felt comfortable having lunch with the head of Universal?
Do you know what I've you know what I think what's quite nice about being Scottish actually is that like at all you know any American's impressive to me. You know, like, I feel as if you all know Batman and things like that because you've got these cool accents, you know. So like I'm daunted just getting off the plane out there, you know, and I just see everyone as the same, you know, like there's an expression over here that we're all Jock Tamson's bairns, right? Which will make absolutely no sense to anyone. But the idea is that we're all just flesh and blood, you know? So I've never sort of walked into a situation and thought, you know, I'm not worthy to be in this place or anything, you know? So it's just, to me, it's just fun, you know? I mean, and I especially see like anything that comes from the comic is just gravy. Like there's video games of some of these books and there's merchandise of Kick-Ass and all that and Kingsman and everything. And I see movies a bit like that. Although I'm a massive film fan, I just see, hey, this is hilarious. They're making a film of this comic book I've done. But for me, it's always about the comic. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I know we're going to wrap up pretty soon. A number of years ago, there was the famous Kirkman-Bendis tussle in the Kirkman Manifesto about doing creator-owned work, getting away from Marvel and DC. But it could have just as easily been the Miller Manifesto had you recorded it. When did you sort of see this as the writing on the wall? Like, I have to make my own things. I have to get away from doing these other things. And I can't imagine you're not happy with the result of that choice.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, there was actually a moment, I can put it again down to a specific phone call, and I was talking to Stan Lee, believe it or not, you know, and it was, I was interviewing him for a magazine, and there was a magazine over here, there still is, which is great, called SFX, and they had an issue where they had guys who are doing a job now interviewing the people who did that job when they were kids. So they had like Russell T. Davis speaking to the women who used to produce Doctor Who, you know, when Russell was doing Doctor Who, when he just rebooted it. And like they had me contact Stan Lee and interview Stan and talk to him about comics. And we had a great chat. And yeah, it was actually really exciting. You know, I mean, phoning Stan, I'd never spoken to him before, except once at a signing. And phoning Stan was like phoning Galactus or something. I mean, it was amazing. It was so exciting. And I recorded the call and I listened to it about three times, you know, not even just to transcribe it. I was just excited to be talking to Stan.
The best moment I ever had in this job when we were doing it full time is we went to Stan's office and recorded a show with him. And
amazing.
And he was so lively and like we were batting back and forth and kind of, you know, making jokes to each other and making fun of each other a little bit and it's one of the greatest days I've ever had. So I know that feeling, obviously.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, like I went to the Playboy Club in 2008 when I was doing that War Heroes tour, you know, when I was in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to the guy in the place he'd invited. It was really exciting, actually. I checked into the Playboy Club. I've checked into my hotel and the Playboy Club was at the top of the hotel, you know, the Palms Hotel or something. Mm-hmm. And there was a Playboy envelope left for me. And I opened it up thinking, what the hell is this? And they said, hey, we're big fans of your books. Do you want to come upstairs and come to a party tonight? And I was like, they knew I was in town doing a signing. And I was was like, this is amazing. This is so great, you know. So I headed up and they told me that Stan Lee had been there the week before. And I was clocking off about 3 or 4 a.m. or something drunk. And they were saying, oh, Stan was going till 5 or 6. And he was up dancing on stage with two scotches in his hand, you know. And I thought, and I think Stan was about 86 or something at the time. And I thought, this is, Stan is the man. That's why he's called the man, you know. So anyway, to get back to it, like Stan said to me, hey, it's really great. You know, I was doing Ultimates, Ultimate X-Men, and I was doing a crossover series called Ultimate War. And I think I actually had 4 books in the top 5 the month that I was talking to Stan on the phone. And I remember feeling very proud of myself and like, yeah, this is pretty amazing and all that, you know. And Stan said to me, yeah, it's great. You know, he says, but why don't you just create your own characters? And he said, you doing this is like me doing Batman and Superman instead of creating the Marvel Universe. He said, why don't you create your own stuff? And he said, I can't remember his exact words, but the sense of it was pop culture atrophies if we don't have new things coming in, you know. So imagine Stan had just written Tarzan and Sherlock Holmes and Superman instead of creating Spider-Man and Fantastic Four. And I thought, oh my God, you know, it's kind of your responsibility as somebody who works in comics to create some new stuff. So I literally went off for me and did want it, just did it almost immediately. And then I also noticed, like, when I was at Marvel, I was seeing things that we were doing being used in the Marvel movies. I mean, I saw the stuff at early stages because I was doing some consultancy work for them. And I thought, I could just do this myself. You know, I could just create my own characters. And, you know, a lot of the stuff from Ultimates would be in maybe Hulk or, you know, the second Hulk movie or the first Captain America movie. And, you know, I saw the plans for the Avengers very early on. And Zach Penn said to me, oh, there's a lot of stuff from Ultimates here. And I thought, do you know what? I'm just going to do this myself. You know, so it was quite a big step, you know, but I just sort of jumped and I was getting paid more than I'd ever been paid in my life. You know, Bendis and I were on these amazing rates at Marvel and I just thought, I'm going to take the risk and work for nothing for a year, you know. And I went off and sort of did these books full time, which was, thinking back, insane, you know. But it worked out, you know. It was I'm still doing the same job, but I own everything now, which is fantastic. You know, the artists and I, 50-50, own every one of these things, where a generation before this would all have been owned by Marvel and DC, which would have been heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. So do you see, is the door shut on working for those guys again, or would you do it for fun?
I do it for fun, you know, like, it's funny, I mean, I was talking to Dan DiDio last week, and I really like that, and I'm still great friends with the Marvel guys as well, you know, and I've talked to both of them at some point about doing something. I think it would be at least a year or two away, because I think we're shooting 3 films next year, and I'm doing the sequel comics to a lot of those films and everything, so just time-wise, but, you know, if you've ever had a Batman costume as a kid or a Spider-Man mask or something, you know, it never leaves you. It's always there. You can't really see it as like graduation, you know, although from a business point of view and a creative point of view, it can be, you know. But there is always that part of you that I'm excited to see Batman versus Superman, even if there's an excellent chance it'll be crap, you know. But like, you know, but I'm still kind of excited, you know.
That's the industry viewpoint. Eh?
And I'm excited about Civil War and everything, you know, and like there is that inner fanboy that just must be fed occasionally, and you know, the idea of doing a big Justice League project or a big Batman project with Steve McNiven or, you know, whoever, Sean Murphy or something, you know, Frank Quitely and I doing an Aquaman series or something. Like, I keep a notebook, and I have done for years, where if an idea for an Aquaman story pops into my head, I write it down, and I've got them all, you know. I mean, I've got a great Green Lantern story, you know. So I mean, at some point I'll definitely dip in and have a shot, but I would only do like a one-off big thing with a really great artist, you know, and I definitely do plan to them.
It's interesting. One of the things that's really interesting talking to you, and I've heard this with other things, is that either you're very good at presenting a version of yourself, or you seem extremely unjaded about this. You're still enthusiastic about the same sort of concepts that you have been.
Oh my God, I mean, the only way... The only way you could get jaded is if you're having a bad time. I mean, I sort of get that. Like, you know, at the end of Raging Bull, De Niro is jaded sitting on that chair. You know, it's like, I get it though, because, you know, that's when it hasn't worked. But it's impossible to be jaded when you're doing what you wanted to do. Like I said, when I was 5 and hand drawing individual lashes and these things. So, I mean, the idea that I get to play with this stuff and make up stories and that people buy, I mean, my God, it's incredible. Or to walk on a movie set and see what was a drawing suddenly become a thing somebody spent $80 million of their own money on is just nuts, you know. I mean, I think I feel like the least jaded person I know, you know, because I love doing what I do.
I think that's got to be part of the gift for being good at this job, I think.
I think the minute you don't like it, you should never do anything. You know, I mean, if there's anything in your life that feels toxic, mm-hmm. I think, you know, you should remove it. You know, it's like if you dread the alarm going in the morning, you're in the wrong job.
Yeah, you can say no. Let's be honest here. I think that's about all that I have. I think we touched on a lot of the books that you've got going on. I know you've got a new book coming out later this fall, Huck, with Raphael Albuquerque.
Yeah, it always looks like I've got tons of stuff, but it's only because they're finite. You know, like every one of the books wraps up after a few months. Like Crononauts I did earlier this year, so we've got the book out in September. Yeah, like the 9th of September. Mm-hmm. Then October, we've got the first volume of Jupiter's Circle, which is the prequel to Jupiter's Legacy, and that's been collected now. And then November is Huck. And Rafa and I have just had a ball on this. I mean, I wrote the whole series 6 months ago. I wrote it. My new philosophy, so the books always come out in time, is to write them a year before they come out and have them all drawn before I start publishing, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. It's worked wonders this year because the books come out on time. But Rafa's amazing. And I checked in with Scott Snyder before he and I were working together because I didn't want to mess with the American Vampire schedule. But Rafa's so fast, he can draw two books a month. It's fantastic. It's great. I mean, this is like, imagine me working with Frank Quitely and Brian Hitch and everyone, and then suddenly with a guy who can draw two books a month, it's like, it's amazing.
It must be like going from black and white to color. It just,
This is what cocaine must feel like. Yes.
Do you still get that feeling when you get pages in your email that come in?
Some things genuinely really excite me in the mornings. Like when I switch on my computer and you know you see your emails loading in from the night before, and if I see something from Frank Quitely or I see something from Sean Murphy or something, I'm like, yes. And I just, even if I'm holding the baby or something, I'll drop the baby, you know, kind of thing, and I'll just, if it's an early morning feed or something, I'm like, oh. And I pounce on it, you know, and I soak it up. And then what I do, and every one of my friends at work will confirm this, what I do is I forward it to almost everyone I know. And it sounds insane, you know, but like all the guys I work with plus school friends or whatever, if there's six pages in from Frank Quitely or something, there's about maybe 20 or 30 comic professionals who are really good friends of mine who I send these pages out to all the time. And they're actually, because I generally work with really good guys, they are interested, you know, they're like, oh, this is really cool, and I'll send Frank a nice note and everything as well. But I even send it to school pals and neighbours and things. I'm like, check out the perspective on panel two.
Like, yeah. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't care. Just please, can we block you on email? You know, but I love it when that stuff comes in. The other thing that's exciting is somebody who you loved as a kid coming through, like Mark Hamill emailing me, is another really exciting email to get as well. So like Frank Quitely art and Mark Hamill emails coming through, that's a buzz. You know?
That's not bad work if you can get it.
Oh my God, if you'd have told me when I was seven that I'd be having a beer with Luke Skywalker when I'm older and hanging around a bit with him, you know, I'm off to LA in 3 weeks' time and I'm going to buzz Mark and his family up when I'm there, you know, like, I mean, that's like dream come true stuff. Sometimes I do worry that I banged my head about 15 years ago and I'm actually vegetating somewhere, you know, and I'm hallucinating all of this because it is kind of like the most fun stuff I can imagine.
There's nothing wrong with that. If that's the case, just let it ride.
Yeah, just don't wake me up. Don't wake
me on the machine. That's totally fair.
No by mouth. No by mouth.
Well, thanks so much. It was a lot of fun to talk to you.
You too. Thanks very much, Josh.
And there we have it. I think that was a pretty great conversation with Mr. Mark Miller. You can find him over at millerworld.com and follow him at Mr. Mark Miller on Twitter. And make sure to check out his comics and see his movies. And there's a lot of stuff that he's putting out, is what I'm saying. You can also get over to ifanboy.com. You can follow us at ifanboy on Twitter, facebook.com/ifanboy. You can go find the old video show where we had Mark Miller on, I think with Tony Harris, way back when they were doing their War Heroes tour, because we've been around a very long time. Well, that's all. Thanks very much, and thanks for listening. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means, and I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also like, one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ifanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ifanboy.